Some might say it's a house on several acres. To others, it's that corner office with great view or a multi-million dollar portfolio. Question, how do you find contentment? See how your view compares to the Apostle Paul's next on Grace to You. It's said that everyone lies in one of two tents, either content or discontent. The issue is making sure that you're in the right one, and if not, learning what it takes to change your address. The Apostle Paul certainly knew what it took to be content, even when he was thrown in jail for preaching Christ, shipwrecked and starving, or beaten and left for dead. Yes, contentment is possible in any circumstance. And today, John MacArthur shows you Paul's example for the secret to contentment. And that's the title of his current study here on Grace to You. Today's lesson is from the second chapter of Philippians. Find your place there as John starts things off.
Do all things without grumbling or disputing. And that, of course, is the substance and basis of the exhortation for our text. We looked at that last time, and today I want to give you the reasons for obeying that. They are given in verses 15 and 16. So the command is in verse 14. The reasons are in verses 15 and 16. Before we look at them, however, let me go back and just touch a little bit on this matter of complaining. Social critic Christopher Lash wrote, and I quote, "Every age develops its own peculiar forms of pathology, which express in exaggerated form its underlying character structure," end quote. And I would suppose that he would agree that the pathology of our age is narcissistic self-indulgence. We are a culture who conduct ourselves like that legendary Greek youth Narcissus, who was looking in a pond one day and saw himself and fell furiously in love with himself. And so much in love with himself that he kept staring in the pond, pining over this shadow of himself which he loved. Rapturous was his self-love. And it seems as though we have found ourselves in the pathology of narcissism in our society. And as we continue to love ourselves, as we continue to indulge ourselves, we continue to breed within ourselves a very great discontent. We add the fantasy world that is around us, the fantasy world that demonstrates to us that there should be out there some plastic perfection. We see it on television. We never seem to attain it, and so our narcissism only casts us into deeper shadows of despair. We feed on self-indulgence. Having everything, we still brood over what we don't have. We complain to the degree that we are rarely, if ever, satisfied. I think there's another factor in our complaining. At MIT, there is a psychologist by the name of Kenneth Kingston, made an interesting statement. Listen to what he said. If you live in a society where you believe the public institutions are deeply flawed and not easily improved, that leaves the pursuit of individual happiness in a private way as the main challenge to your energies, end quote. And I really believe that we are living in that time today. I think we are a more than ever complaining society, not only because we are more indulgent than ever, because we are more exposed to a fantasy world which we can't attain than ever, but also because we have become disillusioned about the social things that once gripped our hearts, and we have left only the pursuit of personal happiness. In the 60s, we had all of the protesting students. They tried and they failed to change the flawed institutions of our society. And when they realized that all of their efforts and all of their work could not change the flaws of the social institutions, they then became the materialistic, money-hungry, success-oriented yuppies of the 70s and 80s who said, "We can't change the social institution. We will pour all of our energies into our own personal pursuit of happiness." And that's where our society is. Madly pursuing things and fulfillment and happiness, narcissistically looking at itself, wanting to indulge itself, realizing it can do very little to change social institutions, it begs the issue of self-indulgence by constantly focusing on that. And built into it is terrible, terrible potential disillusionment. So you have a mood of complaint. And I see it every place. You see it all over. You are part of it. Let me give you some things that people complain about. Now you have to think about this and think about how frivolous they are and see if you don't identify. Here are typical things that cause people to have increased blood pressure, that make them angry, hostile, even and sometimes make them violent. Things like, for example, traffic jams bring incredible hostility, anger, complaint. Slow drivers in front of you can be enough to cause you to lose your sanctification. Freeway cutters who cut in front of you. Talkative people irritate you. Long lines, short lines, any lines. Having one person in front of you makes you complain. You want it your way and now. Crying babies. If you don't think there is a terrible, frightening, brooding discontent over crying babies, then ask yourself why there is such an increase of frightening child abuse precipitated by crying babies, once held to the breast of a mother, now hit with an iron or a frying pan or who knows what. Phone calls at inappropriate times. Misplaced keys, would you believe? Great trauma caused by that. Non-housebroken puppies. I mean, we really get distressed by the biggies, don't we? But you see, it's a mood. Stuck zippers. Especially if you're already in the car halfway there. Cold food. We not only want it, we want it the temperature we want it. Somebody interrupting your conversation. Noisy neighbors. Being rushed by your husband. Late airplanes. Tight clothes. Unsuccessful diets. Peeling onions. Squeaking doors. Incompetent people around you. Flat tires when you're in a hurry. Doing the dishes. Your mother-in-law. Weeds. High prices. These are the things that, imagine it, these are the things that generate hostility in people, cause tremendous conflict in marriage. We complain about all these things. How ridiculous. Now, if you're in Hiroshima and it's 1945, you have a problem worthy of considerable concern. But just because you lost out on a promotion or a business deal, just because your child announced last week that she hates her room, just because the bank notified you this morning that you're overdrawn, I'm sure you can find a way to survive. Calm down, review the situation, think it through. I hear all about midlife crisis. Do you know that there are nations in the world that don't ever have midlife crisis because they don't live that long? Some people aren't bothered by such things at all. There are parts of the world where the average lifespan is 37 years, and men and women are spared the distressing reality of a 40th birthday. Some people complain about grocery bills. More than 10,000 people die of starvation every day. And you're complaining about grocery bills? Millions more suffer from malnutrition. Some people say they complain about the high cost of rent. Well, maybe you'd rather be a pavement dweller in Calcutta. They don't pay rent. They're born, live, and die on the pavement. The only thing they have to worry about is to find a rag they can put under their head and they go to sleep. You see, while these kinds of horrors go on around the world in sort of normal, accepted pace, we throw tantrums because we got seated at a poorly located table in a fancy restaurant. Or we're frustrated because we can't lose 10 pounds. Or we gripe about our monthly debts. You've got problems relative to what? But you see, it's the mood of the mob to complain. And then the idealistic, fantasy-oriented, consumptive culture feeds the sin of discontent. How can we be discontent? Remember Lamentations 3:39, why should any mortal being or anyone offer complaint in view of his sins? What do we have to complain about? So Paul gives us a general principle in verse 14. And it really speaks to us at a time when we live in a culture of complaint. Do all things without grumbling or disputing. Do all things without grumbling or disputing. What do the all things refer to? The living out of your inward salvation, the working out of your salvation. Here is the pervasive attitude for the Christian's experience. As we work out our salvation, as we live our godly life, we are to do it without ever complaining about the circumstances which God has put around us. We are to live a life without complaint. We are to rejoice always, to use Paul's later terminology, and again I say rejoice. We are to be content whether we are abased or whether we abound, whether we have much or whether we have little, whether we like the circumstances or don't like them. There is no place for complaining. And I only submit to you that it's much more difficult, it seems, in this culture than in some, because we are breeding a culture of complainers. Absolute culture of complainers. And Paul then gives us a general principle that does speak to us very directly. Now, note, as I pointed out last time, that this matter of doing all things without grumbling or disputing has reference to God. Not so much grumbling, disputing among others. That too is a sin. But the idea here is to accept that providential plan which God has ordained for your life. Live out your salvation without any complaints directed at Him. A joyful heart, a thankful heart. No emotional grumbling, that's the grumbling word, and no intellectual disputing or arguing with God. But rather, without complaint, gratefully we live out our salvation. That is what he calls for Christians to maintain in terms of an attitude that pervades all their living. Now, he gives us three reasons why. Okay, and I'll just lay these before you. They're not new. They're just a brief review, a summary, and I know you will be familiar with them, but nonetheless, they are the word of the Spirit of God for us today. Reason number one, in verse 15, that you may prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach. Let's say, first of all, then, we are to stop complaining for our own sake. For our own sake. That we might be the kind of children that God has saved us to be. It starts with us. And this is, by the way, clearly a purpose result clause. A little particle hina with a subjunctive always indicates purpose result. And so it could be translated in order that, or with the result that, or given the purpose that. In other words, this is the very reason why you are to do this. So that you will be a blameless, harmless, above reproach child of God. You are called to be all that a child of God should be. In Ephesians 5:1, that very, very important injunction of Paul, where he says, be imitators of God as beloved children. Be imitators of God as beloved children. If God is your father, then imitate God. Then pattern your life after Him. If you are a child of God, then live the way a child of God should live, manifesting the character of God. As it says in Titus 2, adorning the doctrine of God in the manner in which you live. So, note again then, we'll look at the verse specifically. You are to stop complaining, doing all things without grumbling or disputing, in order that you may prove yourselves to be. Now, the Greek literally says, in order that you may become. in order that you may become. And I believe here is a process. You are to be in the process of becoming a blameless, innocent, above reproach child of God. So you are not to complain in order that that process may work, that you may be in the process at the end of which you become a harmless, blameless, above reproach child of God. Now those two words, blameless and harmless, or some of your translations will say blameless and innocent, really are not a great deal apart in terms of meaning. They both speak of moral purity. Blameless simply means a life that can't be criticized. A life that can't be criticized. There's nothing for which you can be held responsible by way of sin, evil, wickedness. It's a life without blame. It's a life that has no blemish, no blot on it, no sinful stain which people can discern and see. And then the word innocent could be translated harmless. It is so translated in Matthew 10:16, where Jesus says, "Be wise as serpents and harmless as doves." It is also translated simple in Romans 16:19. I think it is, Paul says that we are to be simple concerning evil. It has to do with being pure. It has to do with being unmixed, unadulterated, undefiled. It is used, for example, to refer to unmixed wine and unalloyed metal. So he's simply using two somewhat basic terms, saying that your life is to be a life which cannot be criticized for sin and which is pure and undefiled and unadulterated and unmixed with evil. So really two ways to say essentially a pure life. A life without fault and a life without flaw. That's God's desire for His people, that their character and their conduct should be so pure that they cannot justly be accused, that they are above criticism that is legitimate. There is no foreign element which contaminates their life. We are to be, in the terms of 2 Corinthians 11, a chaste virgin, a pure virgin. In terms of Ephesians 5, the church is to be a blameless, without spot, without blemish bride. Same concept. Then you'll note also in verse 15, he uses the term above reproach. That too is one word in the Greek. You have amemptos, akarios, and then you have amomos. All of them have an alpha privative, which means they're negative terms. And this means above reproach. Faultless, flawless, spotless, blemishless. This word, by the way, is used in the Greek Old Testament in Numbers, I think it's several times, Numbers 6:14, Numbers 19:2, I found in both places. And it's there referring to a sacrifice, without blemish, without spot, the kind of sacrifice to be brought to the Lord. So really three ways he's saying the same thing. Harmless, blameless, flawless, faultless, sinless, pure. That's what he wants. Why? And the key is this, children of God. You are to be becoming the proper kind of child of God. In other words, the kind that would rightly represent God, that would be believable if you said, "I belong to God. He's my father. I'm his son. I'm his child." We are to be truly God's children, not only by divine decree, but by testimony as well. In Romans 12, we are to present our bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God. So we are like a sacrifice to be without spot, without blemish, without stain, undefiled, pure. We're children of God. We have to get in touch with that. Who do you belong to? Whose are you? Who owns you? Whose name do you bear? Whose identity do you share? Whose life do you share? The very life of God. And so every believer needs to live in consistency with who he is. Peter gives us a good motivation, I think, in 2 Peter 3. He's talking about the second coming of Christ when he comes, day of the Lord. And he says in verse 14, "Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things," in other words, since you look for the coming day of the Lord, the intervention of Christ in the world, the second coming, "since you look for these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, spotless and blameless." In other words, if you know Christ is coming, that ought to clean up your life. If you know His coming is imminent, that ought to keep clean up your life. You live in the light of the coming of Christ. You're His child. Jesus is coming for you. You want to behave as a child of God should behave. Because we are children, we bear the Father's name. And we need to be sure that we are consistent in living a life that will speak well of the name we bear. That means no complaining in this context. No complaining. If you are a complainer, a grumbler, a griper, a bellyacher, if you are a disputer with God, or if you are a grumbler, and if you are discontent, and if every little thing in life, from stuck zippers to slow drivers and all of the other stuff, causes you to blow your fuses in discontent and complain and so forth, then you have distorted the picture that some are seeing with regard to the child of God. You have sinned. You are not without blemish. And that's a tragedy. So for your own sake, because of who you are, it is mandatory that you obey the injunction of verse 14 in order that you might properly represent the children of God. I remember as a boy, I mentioned this to you some years ago, getting caught in a very compromising situation and having a deacon of my father's church say to me, "Don't you know who your father is? How can you act like that?" That has stuck in my mind as a spiritual truth. I do not want to behave in any way or conduct myself in any matter of conduct which will cause someone to say, "Don't you know who your father is? How can you act like that?" Second point, when we talk about the reason for obedience, not only for our own sake, but for the sake of the unsaved. Here's a very basic principle here, for the sake of the unsaved. He says in verse 15, "You are to become blameless and innocent children of God, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life." This is the main issue. Evangelism is primarily a matter of God's children shining as lights in a dark world. But doing that effectively comes down to two things: character and content. It's not just what you say, it's also what you are. Now, would you notice verse 15, just to get you in touch with the specifics? He says, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. And he there borrows a phrase from the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 5. In Deuteronomy 32, Moses characterized apostate Israel as a crooked and perverse nation. And here, Paul borrows that phrase to characterize the whole world in which the church exists. We are living in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. And that is something we need to be very careful to understand.
Sweet, thankful, uncomplaining attitude gives credibility to the gospel you proclaim. An important principle from John MacArthur's lesson today, his goal, helping you take hold of the secret to contentment. And that's the title of John's current study here on Grace to You. Well, with contentment in mind, something important for you to know is this. As a ministry, as a Bible-teaching Christian organization, Grace to You is content. We're encouraged. And we have a settled trust in the Lord to sustain this work here. John, talk about that for a minute.
We do have a settled trust in the Lord to sustain the work here, and in that we're content. We're content in Him. We're content in His will. We're content in His Word. We're not content with ourselves. We need a lot of spiritual progress in our own lives. We want to come up with new and fresh ways to communicate the Word of God further and further into the darkness of this world. So while on the one hand we're not satisfied with ourselves, we are certainly satisfied with our Lord. We are thankful, even though there are many other things that we want to do, we are thankful for what God has done through His grace in this ministry. Everything we do here is about reaching people with God's Word right where they are. That means where they are geographically or where they are spiritually. And we know God's truth penetrates and transcends culture and circumstances.
How do we define successful ministry? Not by the outcome, only the effort. We define it as teaching the truth as clearly as we can, as far and wide as we can. We also don't and can't generate financial response. We have to trust the Lord for the fruit of the teaching and for the financial response. We grow. We do what we can do based on what God provides. We don't presume on God. We don't go out on a limb. We simply make our needs known, and He provides. And with whatever He provides, we carry on this ministry. Take advantage of our ministry, will you? When we offer a free book, free CD, free downloads, we want you to know that we're glad to provide these things. In fact, we want to send you a free copy of a book I've written called Anxious for Nothing. It's a book to put an end to your worry, free to anyone contacting us for the first time.
Perhaps John's current study is helping pinpoint areas in which you lack contentment. If so, let me urge you to get a copy of Anxious for Nothing. It lays out a clear path away from anxiety and fear and toward peace and contentment. Again, this book is free if you're contacting us for the first time. Pick up your copy today. Send your email request to letters@gty.org or write to Grace to You, Post Office Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. You can also call the toll-free number 1-800-55-GRACE. Again, if it is your first time to write or call us, we'll send you a free copy of Anxious for Nothing. And if you have been in touch before, the cost for the book is $10.50. Shipping is free. Call toll-free 1-800-55-GRACE or order online at gty.org. While you're at that website, let me encourage you to take advantage of all the free resources, including a daily devotional, applications for your smartphones, a streaming video of our television program, and most of all, 3,000 sermons by John, each about an hour long, available free for download. It's all free at gty.org. And remember, you can also buy dozens of John's books, including recent titles like Slave, the collection of John's pastoral prayers called At the Throne of Grace, or Ian Murray's biography of John MacArthur, simply titled John MacArthur, Servant of the Word and Flock. Might be some great Christmas gift ideas for you. Order online at gty.org. And now for John MacArthur and the staff, I'm Carl Miller, inviting you back tomorrow for another half hour of Unleashing God's Truth, one verse at a time, here on Grace to You. When the world's eating chef salads and all you have is croutons, how do you stay content? Another look at the secret to contentment on tomorrow's Grace to You.